If you could only eat one food every day for the rest of your life, you would probably get so tired of it that it would become a fate worse than death. So let's ask a different question. If you could only eat food from one specific country for the rest of your life, what country would you choose? There's all sorts of edge cases here that, you know, you can decide to answer your own way. Like, you know, is pizza American or Italian? You know, is, like, chicken tikka masala Indian or British? But, yeah, you can figure out your own answers to that. What country would you choose? There are a lot of interesting national cuisines in the world. I personally think I would choose either Chinese or American, but both of those kind of feel like cop-outs, kind of feel like cheating, because those are both just incredibly huge, diverse countries that have lots of different cultural food traditions, so I'd basically be selecting, you know, just very large categories of food there. But there's one national cuisine that I would put pretty high on my list that I doubt would rank high on a lot of other people's lists. British food. You know, the food that everyone says is the worst in the world. To which I say, how can you knock this? I'm here at a pub in Edinburgh, about to tuck into a sumptuous full breakfast of bacon and eggs and baked beans and black pudding and a scone and cream tea and a shoggoth. This is Mrs. Sludds. I introduced her in the last episode, but I actually, as of recording this, I haven't recorded that one yet. She is still covered in shrink wrap because I just got her a few days ago from a fan in London. And yeah, I will unwrap her when I get back to Oregon and film the giant squid episode. It's literally not a box, it's shrink wrap. Suit yourself. But like, okay, if it's not that bad, and it really is not that bad, good hearty stuff, why does everyone knock British? Why is it a joke? Why is it a near universal butt of jokes? Well, there's an interesting story behind that. It involves culture, colonialism, and the world's soupiest mystery. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. This is my co-host, Sludds the Shoggoth. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. British food is Northern European food. It's not hugely different from the cuisines of other cold, wet, oceanic European countries. Heavy, hearty, calorie-dense to get you through a long, dark winter. Short growing seasons require you to do a lot of pickling, fermenting, and other pre-refrigeration preservation processes. The staples are beef, fish, and potatoes. Flavorful tropical fruits are far away in the tropics. Not a lot of spices, because the ones we know don't grow in rainy Europe either. Not a lot of fresh vegetables. These features are pretty common to most European food north of the Alps, and they're definitely not for everyone. The specific allegations against British food, it's not seasoned enough, it's bland, it's all boiled, there's some truth to that.
But everything you can say about British food, you can equally say about German or Russian food. And in my experience, people like those. You mention those to the average American, and I think the response would be, yeah, it's good, straightforward stuff. You can't go wrong with meat and potatoes. And you kind of can't. That's exactly how I feel about British food. But German food also isn't considered one of the world's great cuisines. You don't find German restaurants all over the world as easy as you can find, say, Chinese, Japanese, or Mexican restaurants. Northern Europe is not a culinary superpower. Okay, so is that it? Food from Europe isn't that good because they were just working with what they had access to before they colonized the world? Most of the world doesn't like unseasoned food, but I'm white, so I think it's fine. That's what the government wants you to think. And by the government, I mean people on social media who don't realize it's not 2020 anymore and you can go outside now. I have this screenshot saved because it's just like the most 2020 thing imaginable. Two corporate accounts having a conversation as if they're real people. Corporate accounts designed to celebrate slash fetishize particular ethnicities, sort of trying to insult white people, but through a weird imagined stereotype of white people believed only by a mostly white group of extremely online Americans. Ah, yes, seasoned food, a defining feature of people of color culture. I hear that the people of color really like music with notes, too. Why don't we benighted white primitives put notes in our music? Have you ever heard people call Japanese food unseasoned? I mean, it doesn't have a lot of spices, right? Which seems to be the definition of unseasoned all this discourse goes off of, but nobody ever criticizes it for that. Ironically, I think Japanese food in the West is more heavily seasoned than Japanese food in Japan. I've never been to Japan, so I could be wrong about this, but the practice of, like, drowning a sushi roll in several different sauces, I love that, but it seems kind of antithetical to the ethos of Japanese food, which is all about freshness. In Japan, and this generalizes to some other East Asian food cultures, traditionally it's rude to say something is flavorful or well-seasoned because that's taken to mean you over-seasoned it to cover up rotten food or bad cooking. It's America that's obsessed with seasoning things. In fact, I think it's a deeply white American thing to consider seasoning to be synonymous with spices and spices to be the be-all end-all of food quality. I came across this great quote about the seasoning police discourse. The average American understands seasoning exclusively as like a colorful powder that comes out of a jar, and the more of this you add to your food, the more morally correct you are. Now, I've heard it claimed before that something like the Japanese perception of seasoning used to be present in British cooking too. Seasoning was taken as a sign your food isn't fresh. That's why today we think British food is bland. That there's a reason British food doesn't heavily use spices beyond just not having access to spices. Because for many centuries now, they have had access to spices. If you have DNA, you have doubtlessly heard the sentence I'm about to say. Hell, I shouldn't discriminate against the bots watching my video. If you've been trained on the whole internet, you've definitely heard this line too. It's the left-wing equivalent of the attack helicopter copypasta. Say it with me. Europe conquered the whole world for spices and never used any in their food. Tiresome as this cliche may be, there's a point there. A lot of the height of colonialism was driven by the spice trade, notably the British conquest of India. Cinnamon, nutmeg, cardamom, saffron. Wars were started and nations were conquered for those, including by the British. So yeah, why don't you see those in British food? The just-so story you might have heard used to explain this goes like this. Before refrigeration, everyone needed spices to cover up the taste of rotting meat. Your meat was bound to be a little bit rancid, so you had to drown it in spices. Even in Europe, presumably, food was full of spices. Spices were the oil of their time. Everyone used them, everyone needed them, and you couldn't get them at home, so sometimes you had to go to war to preserve your access to spices. In this just-so story, we're led to believe that spices were a lowbrow thing, because spicing your meat was a tacit admission that it was rotten. If you were rich, you could afford meat so fresh you didn't need spices. And as refrigeration reached the masses, the status symbol of fresh, unseasoned food trickled down until all Europe moved beyond the phase where their food was full of spices. This story isn't close to being true, and I'm not sure where it comes from. Premodernist, one of my favorite history YouTubers, has a fantastic video ripping into this myth that mostly hinges on, why would anyone ever eat rotten meat? people's immune systems were probably a little better in those less sanitary days, but humans were humans. Medieval Europeans could get food poisoning. Putting spices on rotten meat wouldn't make it safer or more appetizing. Nobody but Spiders Georg has ever regularly eaten rotten meat, seasoned or not. Before refrigeration, people preserved meat by drying, smoking, or pickling it. The spice trade was about conspicuous consumption. Spices were like gold. They were valuable because they were valuable. It's not like unseasoned food was a status symbol, it was the opposite. If you could afford spices from India, you could afford good fresh meat too. Over time, it became cheaper to ship tropical spices to Europe, or else people found ways to grow them in Europe, so they declined as a status symbol. Once everyone could get spices, nobody wanted them, and high-class food became less heavily spiced. Or at least that's the trajectory of the use of some spices in the Anglosphere, like nutmeg, which used to be way more ubiquitous than it is today. That's why Britain conquered the world for spices and didn't use them in their food. To the extent that the second half of that is true at all, which it's mostly not. The fact is, British food is full of spices and always has been, just not the same ones they use in the tropics. Pepper, salt, mustard, those are so ubiquitous to you, you probably barely even see them as spices. Of course, like I said in the intro, it's always difficult to define what country a food quote-unquote comes from. On a very basic level, countries are made up, and every culture is a jumble of influences from other cultures. The Japanese don't consider ramen to be Japanese, they consider it Chinese food. A lot of what we think of as Indian food was invented in Britain, so is vindaloo also British food? It's a relatively common contrarian take to hear that British food is actually very spicy, way spicier than American food, because these days British people eat Indian food as often or more as the late fish and chips or a full breakfast. Hell, fish and chips were originally considered a Portuguese Jewish food, and that was a staple in Britain for decades before people started thinking of it as inherently British. Is vindaloo not British because it uses non-native ingredients? Well, potatoes are non-native ingredients. Potatoes, as we know them, were invented by the Incas, and they didn't become common in Europe until the mid-18th century. You want truly authentic British food, everything you're used to using potatoes for, you're going to have to use turnips. And then I will fully agree with you that British food is awful. But when people say British food is awful, they don't mean vindaloo or chicken tikka masala. They mean a vague archetype of cheap, unevenly heated fried food, watery soups, and tough sausages. A cultural construct divorced from actual food eaten in Britain and, I think, most people's thoughts on it. British food is a meme, a centuries-old meme that exists independently from people's opinions of what British people actually eat. Don't believe me? Check out this fascinating survey. This is a 2019 YouGov poll of 25,000 people to determine the world's favorite cuisines. Apparently, it's Italian, followed by Chinese and Japanese, which is kind of what I'd have expected. Those are damn good. But British food doesn't score too terribly. It has a 50% approval rating across the world, which is above average for the 34 national cuisines people were asked about. The further you get down this list, the more I think things are complicated by small sample size. How many Singaporeans do you think have eaten Argentine food? I don't trust this 35% approval rating. Everyone loves Thai food except the Saudis, which may also be a fluke of low sample size. Nobody likes Finnish food, it seems, except the Finns, but who's ever tried Finnish food? I have because I've been to Finland. It's all right. It's heavy on reindeer meat. Especially in the north, the Finns really do eat reindeer meat as a staple. It's not just for tourists, like haggis in Scotland. Like, a lot of countries have a weird sort of gross national dish that people within the country don't like much more than foreigners do. Like, Norwegians don't eat lutefisk often. French people don't eat snails often. But Scottish people really do eat haggis all the time, and Finns eat reindeer all the time. That's a tangent. Let's get back on track. British food gets some pretty bad reviews in this survey, but notably the countries with really scathing assessments of British food are other European countries, where the meme that British food sucks is present in the culture. Two of the countries that like British food the least are Germany and Denmark, which sure are pots calling the kettle black. Not that German or Danish food is bad, it's just made out of a lot of the same stuff as British food. Spain and France also hate British food, but they're countries that are relatively close to Britain that have their own detailed, beloved food traditions. Of course they think they're better than their neighbors. And then the country least likely to enjoy British food, it seems, is Japan, although in general, the Japanese people polled in this survey didn't seem to like most foreign foods. And anecdotally, try going around asking people if they like fish and chips, or shepherd's pie, or beef Wellington, or a full English breakfast. Unless most people you know are vegans, I think they'll say they do. But then, if you live in a Western country, you then ask, okay, so do you like British food? And they'll say, of course not. When people dissing British food name specific dishes, usually it's stuff that is objectively gross that no one eats anymore, like jellied eels, or dishes that are basically memes in themselves, like a toast sandwich. People like British food until they're told it's British. So, is it less rooted in dislike of the food than dislike of the British? Why would anyone dislike the British? There's a factoid I heard a long time ago, sort of in the same genre as the conquered the world for spices quip, that the most widely commemorated national holiday in the world is Independence from Britain Day. This could sort of be true, I think, if you cherry-pick the data the right way. You go off, like, celebrated by the most people rather than celebrated by the most countries, because 5 of the world's 10 most populous countries did once become independent from Britain. You classify all holidays that celebrate something similar as the same holiday regardless of when they fall, because the US, Nigeria, and India, Pakistan, Bangladesh all became independent from Britain at very different times and celebrate their independence at different times of year. That doesn't seem crazy to me. I mean, Christmas isn't even consistently celebrated on the same day worldwide. I still think even with that methodology, religious holidays and New Year's overtake Independence Day, but it's up there. I mean, here's a map of the countries worldwide that have never fought a war with Britain. I'm pretty confident this map is real. Comedy frowns on making the weak the butt of the joke. I've said in my Jerry Lewis video and referenced again more recently that humor is rarely immortal or universal. But there are some universal themes, and a category of humor that I think is fairly immortal is making the strong appear weak. In the days of the height of British colonialism, it was not easy to find something the Brits seemed bad at. They were better than anyone else at conquering, industrializing, inventing. They had an empire on which the sun never set. You can't make fun of that even while they're subjugating you, because there's no way to make that seem weak and pathetic. What was their weak spot? What about them could be mocked? Well, their food isn't that great. In fact, as long ago as the American Revolution, which took place long before the British Empire hit their peak, people fighting the British made jokes associating them with bad food, calling the red-coated soldiers lobsters, which at the time were considered poverty food that you only eat as a last resort. No matter what country you're in, making fun of the British is almost always punching up. And since they conquered the world, their food has become easy to find the world over. I don't think jokes about Finnish food really land, because nobody outside Finland has ever tried it. So if you're gonna make fun of any national cuisine, British food is an easy and relatable target. But that's my speculation, and I don't know if it passes muster, because I don't think the meme about British food comes from countries they colonized. The YouGov food survey seems to suggest it's mostly European countries that hate British food. India, which has good reason to hate the British, seems to like British food more than any European country does, except Britain itself. And I trust that sample size, because British food is pretty easy to find in India. Hell, India likes British food even more than Hong Kong does, and Hong Kong is the only former British colony that desperately wishes it was still colonized. There are a few other cases of that. Vietnam has a millennia-old rivalry with China that's deeply ingrained in their culture, enough that the two Western powers Vietnam won brutal wars with in the 20th century, France and America, are now seen favorably by most Vietnamese, since at least they're not China. Ho Chi Minh, who devoted his whole life to freeing Vietnam from the French, came to believe, even as he was still fighting the French, that if an independent Vietnam came to be dominated by their old enemy China, being a French colony was at least better than that. He once said, "I prefer to sniff French shit for 5 years than eat Chinese shit for the rest of my life." And today, according to the Pew Research Center, 78% of Vietnamese now have a favorable view of America, one of the highest approval ratings of the US in the world. They were being napalmed by Americans in living memory, but at least the Americans are not China. There's a reason I went off on this particular tangent. countries have rivalries with their neighbors. Always have, always will. They'll have wars and they'll have alliances with countries on the other side of the world, but it's not common for those to get permanently ingrained in their country's culture the way regional rivalries do. America burned our cities and jungles to the ground was one thing that happened once in Vietnamese history, whereas we are not China, and anyone who's an enemy of China is our friend, is a central part of Vietnamese cultural identity. As we've seen, the meme of hating British food mostly comes from Europe. But let's get more specific than that. We recommend avoiding general and often dehumanizing the labels, such as the poor, the mentally ill, the French, the disabled, the college educated. Instead, use wording such as people with mental illnesses. Yes, this tweet is real. So the Brits' longest cultural rivalry is with people with mental illnesses, or as I still call them because I'm problematic, the f***. Back before Britain and France had colonial empires they could extend across the world and start wars with everyone, they just had each other to fight, so fight they did. Arguably the longest single hot conflict in history, the intermittent Hundred Years' War of the Middle Ages, was fought between England and France. Even once they had colonial empires, they still fought each other. The Seven Years' War in the 18th century is sometimes nicknamed World War Zero because it pitted Britain against France with fighting going on in almost all of their respective colonies. There were theaters of war on almost every continent, and there'd never been a war like that before. And more than just fighting wars, they had a cultural rivalry too. If you met a foreigner in England, they were probably French. They've been the two biggest powers in Western Europe for most of their history, and culturally, they're really not that different. There's no rivalry like a sibling rivalry. Historians like to talk about how Napoleon invented or popularized the modern concept of nation-states, a group of people with a roughly shared language, culture, and/or ethnicity, living within defined borders with a single government whose authority is unquestioned. But I'd nominate a different Frenchman as an early nation-builder, someone who believed that a united country must have a shared culture, and he was going to build that culture. You know him, the Sun King, Louis XIV. He wanted to convince all of Europe that the French way of doing things was the classy way of doing things. He founded art, music, and architectural schools to attract bright people from across Europe. France was where to learn about how to be classy, because nobody else was putting so much money and effort into making their country appear culturally sophisticated. The French language was promoted as the language of the aristocracy, which it remained for centuries, even in places far from France. I read The Brothers Karamazov in high school, which takes place among 19th century Russian aristocrats, and at one point there's a line where, in the middle of a conversation, someone's like, "Should we switch to speaking Russian?" And then someone else says, "Why would we do that? French is just fine." And, you know, I'd obviously assumed that the characters were supposed to be understood as speaking Russian the whole time, but 19th century Russian aristocrats didn't speak Russian. They spoke French because they were aristocrats. There's a reason elite is a French loanword. That's partly why we think of French culture as snooty and aristocratic, because unlike cultures which grew naturally from average people's beliefs and practices, a lot of traditional French culture was consciously invented by aristocrats in order to say, our culture is French culture. This happened in other countries too, but nobody was as good at it as the French. One major part of this era of conscious invention of Frenchness was the invention of a new standard for what high cuisine could be. Elaborate feasts had always been something aristocrats had enjoyed the world over, but there was a new perception under the reign of Louis XIV that cooking should be treated as a fine art. The chef François-Pierre de La Varenne wrote a cookbook in 1651, Le Cuisinier François, codifying a new style of cooking, consciously invented by the French as a break from medieval food traditions. The title simply translates to French cooking, and that's how people all over Europe were meant to take it. From there on out, Varenne's inventions were supposed to be the French cuisine. Here there really was a shift from heavily spiced foods to simpler, fresher flavors, because spices from the tropics were becoming something ordinary people could buy. So as a status symbol, the spiced dishes that used to decorate European aristocrats' tables now seemed a bit tacky. The new way to show your wealth was to demonstrate freshness and attention to minute detail. La Varenne said, "When I eat cabbage soup, I want it to taste like cabbage." Desserts became sweet, and sugar was banished from main dishes. This was new, and pretty tasty, and nobody else was doing it. Word got around among European aristocrats that if you want to keep up with the times, you gotta hire a French chef. The notion that France is the place for quality food became ingrained across Europe, and when the French Revolution struck and anything aristocratic was put under suspicion, French chefs were taken in by royal courts across Europe. Haute cuisine kept getting snootier into the 19th century, when Marie-Antoine Carême, sometimes considered the most influential chef of all time and the real father of French cuisine, became the court chef for the Russian and then English royal families. France had become one of the most food-obsessed cultures in the world, certainly far surpassing practical, stiff upper lip Britain. So the British nobles weren't eating British food in the 19th century. They were eating French food, even as France itself was their main rival as the world's top colonial power. France had successfully built a perception of itself as the world capital of food. When your oldest cultural rival country is the world capital of food, when only that country's food is the global standard for fancy food, well, you develop a bit of an inferiority complex about your own cooking. Of the world's two biggest powers in the mid-19th century, everyone understood that France is the one with the good food. The British, well, their food didn't take the world by storm the way the French did, because they didn't invent a whole new category of food and do an aggressive PR campaign among the crowned heads of Europe. So it must be bad, right? Except one British food around that time did take the world by storm. The sandwich. A well-known story, which I always thought was apocryphal but may well be true, has it that John Montagu, the 18th century Earl of Sandwich, invented it so that he could have a meal while playing a card game without getting his hands dirty. And that speaks to the difference between British and French food better than anything else. Sandwiches were a convenience food, and they caught on with ordinary people. French cuisine was the opposite of convenient, and that's the point, so it caught on with the chattering classes. To the general public, especially today, British food is sometimes seen as bad because it's associated with an uppity and oppressive country. But to the cultural tastemakers of the 19th century, the first time a negative perception of British food became a thing, British food was bad for the opposite reason. It was common and practical and thoroughly lower class. But there was a time when British food really was the worst thing in the world. Churchill is dead, my brother. The planes are no longer overhead. You don't have to eat like this! Britain is an island, which is its greatest natural strength and weakness. It made them good at seafaring, which is how they conquered the world. It kept them from being invaded by the Nazis, but it made it really easy to cut off supply chains in wartime. During World War II, Britain had the harshest and longest-lasting rationing program of any major country fighting the war. They imported most of their food before the war. They had plenty of colonies where things grew better than on their rainy island. But with German submarines encircling British waters, they had to make do with what they could grow at home. Three scientists at Cambridge University were tasked with developing a limited diet, consisting of only foods sourced from Great Britain itself, that could keep the population going. They reported that the people who had tested their experimental diet had only one negative complication: an increase in flatulence. And you'd fart too if you had to eat like they did. The British diet came to consist of root vegetables, beans, and canned meat. In the previous episode, I briefly talked about Wakin, whale meat bacon, which was one of the few meats that was unrationed. Still, nobody bought it. Bananas had been commonplace in the UK since about 1900. By 1942, many British children believed bananas were a magical, fictional food from stories. There were strict regulations on when farmers could slaughter their animals. If an animal got injured in an accident, they were allowed to kill and butcher it to put it out of its misery, but they had to report that to the government. Coincidentally, many cows and pigs happened to fall down holes close to farmers' birthdays. Rationing didn't end when the war ended. In fact, for some foods, it got even worse. Food could enter Britain again, but now all of Europe was starving. There were only so many resources to go around, and to add insult to injury, the late 1940s saw vicious snowstorms across Europe, wiping out harvests that had only started to recover. America, the only major country not totally devastated by the war, and the source of half the world's GDP by war's end, something that had never happened before and may never happen again in world history, they prioritized funding continental Europe's recovery. Britain was less hard hit in the grand scheme of things, so they had to keep their belts tight for a little while longer. It took a full 9 years after the end of World War II for rationing to be fully abolished. By then, there were teenagers who had never lived in a Britain where food wasn't rationed. Meanwhile, thousands of American troops were stationed in the UK, both during the war and after it, and seeing what the public was eating then most likely was what cemented the idea that British food is awful into the American psyche, even if the rest of Europe was already clowning on British food before rationing. Living like that for so long changes people. By then, the Brits were so used to making do with the bland items they had available, it took a while for variety to come back into their diet. Even by 1970, you could still get a lot of laughs out of the concept of a cafe that serves nothing but Spam, because when Monty Python made that skit, the post-war days of eating cheap American canned meat were still in pretty recent memory. Come to think of it, the Monty Python Spam skit is probably the most famous example of the British food is awful meme in global pop culture. And it's made by the most successful British comedians in the world. That's our final reason. Why does the world joke about British food? Because the British love nothing more than joking about British food.
Good heavens! Issue umbrellas! The Scots are firing porridge! Porridge at tea time? The devils, they're trying to unbalance our diet.
Cab, you're right. Not a word to the men.
Of course.
Very well, then. If the Scots want to make it a war of nutrition, we have an English dish in our armory twice as deficient in calories as porridge. And twice as deadly.
Seagoon, you're not going to fire.
Yes. Brown Windsor soup.
The British sense of humor is based on two main things, self-deprecation and complaining. Churchill has a quote along the lines of, "An Englishman is never satisfied unless he is complaining." What I just played is from a 1956 episode of Britain's favorite radio comedy show, The Goon Show, which didn't mean then what it would now. Like Monty Python, who they were a big influence on, they made fun of British food all the time. Rationing had only been off for 2 years when this was made. Complaining, paradoxically, is central to the old stoic, stiff upper lip mentality. When everything sucks, you joke about how much it sucks. That's how you get through tough times. But now that I've exhaustively explained the cultural significance of British food jokes, I want to point out something else in the clip I just showed. Something that, honestly, is sort of the reason I wanted to make this episode in the first place. If you clicked on this video simply to get an answer to the title question, there you go. You've got five of them, and depending on where you are in the world, a different combination of the five is probably true. But please stick around. Listen to this Goon Show clip again. What terrible food, specifically, are the English throwing at the Scots?
Brown Windsor soup.
Brown Windsor soup is such an evocative name. Aspirations to a specifically British sort of classiness, and then the most unappetizing color right there in the name, the color that everyone accuses British food of always being. Okay, that's a stereotype that's kind of true, but a lot of food is brown. Brown Windsor soup was the bane of a generation, but it's also been called the soup that built the British Empire. If you asked a Brit in the post-war era who'd been a child during the Victorian or Edwardian periods, they would invariably say that they grew up having brown Windsor soup everywhere cheap, low-quality food was sold. School cafeterias, railway dining cars, hotel buffets. The clip I played was neither the first nor the last time the Goon Show used brown Windsor soup as the apotheosis of terrible British food. There was one, deeply of its times episode, in which the protagonists injected brown Windsor soup into Chinese people to turn them into Englishmen, nor was the Goon Show the only place brown Windsor soup was mocked in mid-20th century Britain. It showed up in the Carry On movies, another comedy series hugely popular around then, in a 1943 novel by Charles Dickens' great-granddaughter Monica, and a 1947 novel in which a character mentions it being served at, quote, a sordid little hotel. The reputation of brown Windsor soup even spread across the pond. In 1958, the New Yorker ran a restaurant review in which they quipped, A fine brown soup, formerly listed on British menus as a brown Windsor soup, is as hard to imagine as a fine kind of dislocated elbow. As the era when brown Windsor soup was ubiquitous faded further into the past, oddly enough, it seems that memories of brown Windsor soup became more detailed. A 1981 cookbook published by a British-born American woman, intended to prove that British food isn't that bad, used brown Windsor soup as an example of British food that really is that bad. For many years, a particularly unappetizing version was continually served by British railways in their dining cars, which may explain its present demise. Throughout my childhood, I assumed it was the only soup that could be served on a train, and having tasted it once, I knew better than to risk the experience again. She also writes that it's a, quote, hearty beef soup, one of the only times brown Windsor soup gets a description beyond just its color and dreariness. You know what I'm about to tell you, right? Hold on to your bowler hats. Yep. You're right, before the 20th century, there is no evidence that this supposed Victorian staple ever existed. It is a nationwide Mandela effect. The earliest known reference to brown Windsor soup by that name anyone has been able to unearth is from 1926, in which an ad for a cafe in Portsmouth lists soup, tomato, or brown Windsor. And even after this, references to brown Windsor soup on menus or in cookbooks are few and far between, and outnumbered by jokes about how terrible it was, and rationing sucks, but at least we're not all eating brown Windsor soup anymore. All the claims that it was served on trains, purportedly one of the most common places to find brown Windsor soup, are especially perplexing. Of course, the rail historians have gone to work attempting to find some evidence of our soup on a dining car menu. Other than maybe Japan, I think no country but the UK has such a culture of autistic train people, so visible and at least somewhat understood by mainstream society. Of course they have autistic train people everywhere, but in Britain they're a type of person who are familiar to normies. Francis Bourgeois could only come from one country. So obviously they have a devoted workforce who can go through records of every surviving dining car and train station restaurant menu in Britain from the 19th and early 20th centuries, and, as you were anticipating, sure enough, not a single reference to brown Windsor soup, nor anything that could conceivably be misremembered as brown Windsor soup. For obvious reasons, soup was almost never served on trains. What you do find references to, if you go searching through historical sources for brown Windsor soup, is Windsor soup. Windsor soup, which is white, very much was the name of a soup in Victorian Britain. Windsor soup was just as fancy as its name suggests. It was served to Queen Victoria at her titular castle and to London's elite at the Savoy Hotel, and certainly wasn't considered cheap cafeteria slop. Recipes varied. The first known soup called Windsor soup was a thin noodle soup purportedly enjoyed by Kings George III and IV in the early 19th century. Then an influential 1845 cookbook includes a different, heartier soup called calves feet soup a la Windsor. Broth from calves' feet or tails was typically the base of the soup. Beans, rice, barley, cream, and a range of meats were all added to Windsor soup at various points by various restaurants and cookbooks. It seemed to become a catch-all term for a fancy, light-colored soup. By the 1920s, Windsor soup began to trickle down to the masses. You could buy canned soups, again with a wide variety of ingredients, called Windsor soup. But by then, people were already joking about brown Windsor soup, and again, this Windsor soup was not brown. But there was a place the words brown and Windsor belonged next to each other in the Victorian era, a popular brand of soap called Brown Windsor Soap. If you do a search of newspaper archives before World War II for brown Windsor soup, the vast majority of results will be electronic misidentifications of brown Windsor soap. Nobody seems to have hated brown Windsor soap, so it didn't get an afterlife as a meme. If you do a search of newspaper archives after World War II for brown Windsor soap, the vast majority of results will be electronic misidentifications of brown Windsor soup. Ugh, remember when we all had to eat brown Windsor soup gets more attention than remember when we all washed up with that nice-smelling brown Windsor soap. There's a tantalizing line in the otherwise largely forgotten 1962 novel It Was the Nightingale by Henry Williamson, set in the 1920s, that I think is the smoking gun in our mystery. There's this dialogue. The general manager deserves to be drowned in a bath consisting of his own brown Windsor soup. Isn't that a soap? Soup or soap, the taste is the same. At long last, a joke about brown Windsor soup that seems to allow that it didn't exist. So what? This was a huge collective misremembering of brown Windsor soap? I guess those kinds of things do happen, but I don't think so. Not necessarily. People have found a handful of references from the 1920s through 50s to brown Windsor soup as a real soup on menus. At some point, a real soup was served by some people called brown Windsor soup. One of my sources that has searched far and wide for brown Windsor soup, the Foods of England blog, makes this baffling observation. There are a small number, we found three, of references to tinned brown Windsor soup in Scottish and Irish newspapers of the 1940s, and one from England. Odd thing is, these all seem to be one-offs. The adverts are repeated without brown Windsor soup, and we can't find it in any wholesale catalogs. No idea what's going on. You and me both. This makes it seem like there's some sort of cover-up to deliberately scrub evidence of brown Windsor soup having existed from the public record. There are newspaper ads for canned soup that mention brown Windsor, but the version of the ad that included brown Windsor in the list of soups you can get only ran once, and identical ads were rerun with the only thing changed being no more brown Windsor reference. And you can find wholesale catalogs from around this time that will sell you New Forge concentrated soups, but not the brown Windsor variety. There's gotta be a more plausible explanation here than soup conspiracy. I'd say that this happened to be right when brown Windsor soup fell out of favor with the public and canned soup companies discontinued it, but again, this is not just the last, but also one of the first ads for brown Windsor soup under that name. Another blog points out that not only was Windsor soup a thing in the Victorian era, they also had a soup that wasn't anything like Windsor soup and was much more downmarket, simply called brown soup. Here's an 1890 restaurant menu with brown soup. Some ads for bouillon cubes from around the same time recommend using them to make brown soup. In 1895, it's mentioned being served in a nursing home. A 1913 recipe for brown soup seems to reveal that, yes, it's a hearty beef soup, just like the memories of brown Windsor soup. No record of it being served on trains. Again, no soup on trains. That seems to have been a widespread but completely false memory. But I think we have our answer here. In the Victorian era, these three things existed. Windsor soup, which was expensive and aristocratic. Brown soup, which wasn't. And brown Windsor soap, which was a soap. Some sharp Victorian wit, probably a school kid, began calling the watery brown soup served at his cafeteria brown Windsor soup, which was probably a really clever pun at the time. They think they're serving us something as fancy as Windsor soup, but this brown sludge really just tastes like soap. So it's brown Windsor soap soup. It caught on as a nickname for low-quality soups, remembering having heard of Windsor soup, and brown Windsor soap, and probably correctly remembering having had a lot of bad meals on trains and in hotels, people who grew up in the Victorian era, their memory clouded by all the decades of chaos and upheaval since then, conflated all four of these memories. By the time it was being made fun of, people earnestly did remember this beefy soup being called brown Windsor soup, including some people who ran restaurants or canneries. The few establishments that still served brown soup began calling it brown Windsor soup, probably because that's what they thought they really remembered it was called. People change the world to fit our perceptions of it. We are storytelling creatures. We love a narrative. If we believe British food to be bad, our memories will invent bad British foods that we are certain we've had before. In 2017, Vice journalist Ubah Butler, the guy's real name, created a fake restaurant in his London backyard. It was called The Shed at Dulwich. Through fake reviews and fake word of mouth spread by a handful of accomplices, it reached the number one spot in London on TripAdvisor, having never served a single meal. Butler's phone rang off the hook for reservations. Finally, to prove to TripAdvisor that the restaurant was real, Butler opened The Shed at Dulwich for one night only, setting up tables and chairs in his backyard and taking in 10 people who tried to get reservations. For the food, he served reheated TV dinners, artfully arranged on a plate. And people raved about it. People who came all the way from California to go to this restaurant said it really did deserve to be number one in London on TripAdvisor. We remember what we want to remember. We perceive what we want to perceive. I still stand by my kind of controversial claim that quote-unquote propaganda is overrated. Your political enemies don't brainwash you. You are immune to their propaganda. You brainwash you. your memories, your perception of the world around you, that all gets molded to fit the assumptions about the world you've already made. Is British food any worse than anything else you could find in Europe? No. When millions of people say it is, do they earnestly believe that what they've eaten in Britain is unbearable? Yes. And that's okay. At some level, this kind of thing will always happen. Unless you run a British pub, I guess, it's a fairly harmless stereotype. Go get some fish and chips and consider how much the world would love this if they were told it was French.
This